Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Throughout the entire history of the American Basketball Association, only two teams played every one of the nine seasons that the league was a direct rival to the well-established NBA. One was the Indiana Pacers, who in 1976 were one of the four ABA franchises that merged with the NBA. However, the other, for a number of different reasons, didn't join the NBA, was the Kentucky Colonels. During their nine-year history of the ABA, the Colonels had the highest winning percentage in league history and were led by three Hall of Fame players, claimed a league championship in 1975, and won 7 of 9 exhibition games against NBA teams. Hello, I'm Dana Augusta, your host of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a sports history podcast you didn't know you needed. In this all-new episode of the podcast, we will continue with a series that we started a year ago, our Forgotten Franchises series. In this show, we will take a look back at one of the most successful teams in the history of the ABA, the Kentucky Colonels. As a charter member of the ABA, the Colonels lasted the entire run of the American Basketball Association along with the Indiana Pacers. They were one of the league's best-run franchises, and throughout its history, only had one losing season, and that year they still made the postseason. Later in the show, we'll send a shout out to one of their former coaches. In the mid-1970s, the Colonels was his first head coaching job, and he propelled them to their only ABA title. And after the ABA merged with the NBA, he would coach several teams and win Coach of the Year twice, 26 years apart. But he is best known for being one of the best and most knowledgeable color analysts in all of sports television. If there is such a thing as the John Madden of basketball, I would nominate Hubie Brown for that role. Also in this episode, the Chicago Bears are on the clock. The Bears are, after a subpar season, are once again looking to move on from this past year's starting quarterback Justin Fields and draft presumptive number one pick Caleb Williams from USC. Not only are they looking for their quarterback of the future, but they are still looking for their first true great quarterback since Sid Luckman, who retired from the Bears in 1950. Since then, the Bears have had great teams and Hall of Fame players, but not a quarterback. We'll take a quick look at the not-so-great lineage of quarterbacks from the Windy City. That and so much more on this all-new episode of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a member of the Sports History Network.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about the sports yesteryear, and so we're pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings sports history to life. The Row One Gallery features over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, and advertisements in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. Any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. It's your choice. In the Row One shop, you can pick from thousands of unique items that feature retro and historical backgrounds dating back to 1876. We have everything from clothing to phone cases to mugs, even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1 for access to the full Row 1 catalog. When you buy from the gallery today, you can instantly save 15% on your purchase. All you have to do is enter the code SHN15 and your discount will be applied. That's SHN15. That's it. Simple. Save 15% off all your prints in the Row 1 gallery. Just go to sportshistorynetwork.com/row1. And don't forget to check out all the podcasts on the Sports History Network. Soundtrack provided by Kevin MacLeod of filmmusic.io.
One of my all-time favorite movies is 2010, The Year We Made Contact, which is a sequel to the 2001 A Space Odyssey, which was released in theaters in 1984 and stars Roy Scheider, John Lithgow, and Helen Mirren. In one of the scenes, Roy Scheider, who is the leader of an American expedition on a joint mission with Russian cosmonauts to Jupiter, is sharing a bottle of Kentucky whiskey with the captain of the Russian spacecraft, played by British actress Helen Mirren. After taking a sip of whiskey, Mirren's character asks, "So, what do they do in Kentucky?" And Scheider's character responds, "Well, there's a big, big horse race. They play very good basketball, and they have babies just like everybody else." The part of playing very good basketball could be considered an understatement with the hardcore history of the University of Kentucky and Louisville within the Bluegrass State. Yet for 9 seasons, it wasn't just collegiate basketball fans across the Commonwealth of Kentucky were flocking to. From their beginnings in 1967 to the very end of the spring of 1976, the Kentucky Colonels of the American Basketball Association were one of the winningest teams in the NBA and featured 3 Hall of Fame players that were the backbone of one of the most stable franchises in that league's history. It could not be overstated that the Colonels had a built-in advantage of playing in a basketball hotbed of Kentucky, and along with their northern neighbor Indiana, they enjoyed a success in the ABA that other franchises envied. The Colonels and their rivals, the Indiana Pacers, were the only teams that played all 9 seasons, stretching from October of 1967 to May of 1976. They were the 2 of the most successful teams in ABA history. And that league was a direct rival to the NBA with its 3-point shot and its signature red, white, and blue basketball. Unlike its model, the old American Football League that lasted throughout the 1960s, the ABA were not as financially stable, at least some of its teams weren't. For every Indiana Pacers, there were the Anaheim Amigos and the Oakland Oaks and the Utah Stars and the Memphis Tams. For every Kentucky Colonels, there were the San Diego Conquistadors and the Miami Floridians, the Carolina Cougars, and the New Orleans Buccaneers. But the Colonels were different. They were one of the league's strongest teams, and of the 9 seasons that the ABA existed, they made the postseason all 9 years, and claiming the league championship only once in 1976. And throughout its history, they enjoyed a .602 winning percentage, 448 victories, both ABA records. The birth of the Colonels was on March 6, 1967, as a charter member of the American Basketball Association. Louisville businessman Don Regan was the first owner, and their first coach was John Givens. The Colonels' first draft pick was already a legend in Kentucky. They used their first pick in franchise history to select University of Kentucky standout point guard and future Hall of Famer Louis Dampier, who would play for the Colonels their entire history. Dampier, who was also drafted by the NBA's Cincinnati Royals, decided to go to the new league instead. And during his career with the Colonels, he averaged 19 points and 6 assists per game, becoming that league's all-time leader in points and assists. He was a 7-time ABA All-Star, 4-time All-ABA, was on the league's All-Rookie team, and was named to the ABA's All-Time team. Their first season, the 67-68 season, was actually their only season where they finished below .500, And after a brutal start to the regular season where they won only 5 of their first 17 games. However, they finished their inaugural campaign with a record of 36-42, which tied them in the Eastern Division with the New Jersey Americans. And to determine who would get the fourth and final playoff spot in the Eastern Division, the Colonels and Americans were scheduled to play in a one-game playoff game in Long Island, New York. The game was originally scheduled to be played at the T-Neck Armory, the home arena of the Americans, but the arena was not available, so the game had to be moved to Long Island. Notice I said it was scheduled to be played there. Well, with everything that was associated with the ABA, it was just weird. The playing conditions at Long Island Arena were so bad that the Americans had to forfeit the game, giving the Colonels the fourth seed in the playoffs. And in the first round of the playoffs that year, the Colonels had a decent showing, but fell to the Minnesota Muskies in 5 games in the Eastern Division semifinals. The next couple of years, the Colonels remained competitive, going 42-36 in 1969 and 45-39 in 1970. Along with Dampier, there were other standouts, such as Darrell Carrier from Western Kentucky. There was Guth Ligon, who was a standout at Indiana in the mid-60s. And then there was Penny Ann Early. Now, for most teams in the ABA during that time, they were not above publicity stunts. And on Wednesday, November 27th, 1968, in a regular season game against the Los Angeles Stars, Early, who was the first licensed female jockey, made history once again, becoming the first female to play in a men's professional game. During the first half, Colonels coach Gene Rhodes sent Early into the game. Though it was only for one possession, Early made history by making an appearance in a pro basketball game. By 1970, the Colonels were still competitive with a still competitive team on the court and one of the few profitable ones off. That year, the Colonels would select their second future Hall of Famer, once again looking in their own backyard, drafting 6'9" forward Dan Issel from the University of Kentucky. In his 5 seasons with the Colonels, he averaged 26 points and 11 rebounds per game. With his addition, the Colonels were still a playoff team, but needed one more piece to get over that proverbial hump. And that came in the following draft, and boy was it a big piece. In 1971, the Colonel selected 7'2", 7'5" with the Afro, All-American from Jacksonville University named Artis Gilmore. At this point, the Colonels featured 3 future Hall of Famers, Dampier, Issel, and now Gilmore, who that season won ABA Rookie of the Year and League MVP, averaging 24 points, 18 rebounds, and 5 blocks a game. His addition made the Colonels an instant ABA title contender. The team was so good, many people around basketball wondered how well will this team match up with an NBA team. Well, they didn't have to wait long. On September 22, 1971, the Colonels played the NBA's defending Eastern Conference champion Baltimore Bullets in the second ever ABA-NBA exhibition game. In front of 14,000 fans at Freedom Hall in Louisville, the Colonels, behind Issel, Dampier, and rookie center Artis Gilmore, defeated the likes of Wes Unseld, Earl Monroe, and the rest of the Bullets 111-85. And that would be the beginning of what would be the best regular season in team history. The 71-72 Kentucky Colonels not only finished with the best record in the league that year, 68-16, but it also marked the best record of any team in league history. The Colonels' big three of Gilmore, Issel, and Dampier were an integral part of that Colonels team. Issel led the way, averaging 31 points a game, while Gilmore averaged 24-18 and 5 blocks a game. That season, the Kentucky Colonels had 3 instances of double-digit winning streaks, including a 12 consecutive game winning streak, and ended the year winning their last 7 in a row. As mentioned before, Gilmore was the league rookie of the year and ABA MVP, and the Colonels finished with the league's best record and were an overwhelming favorite to win their first ABA title. The Colonels were so dominant in the 71-72 season, they finished 23 games ahead of the Eastern Division second place team, the Virginia Squires, that featured future NBA coach Doug Moe, former North Carolina star Charlie Scott, and rookie forward from the University of Massachusetts named Julius Erving. Yet, for all the success that the Colonels had in the regular season, it did not continue in the postseason. In the opening round of the Eastern playoffs, the Colonels would open against the New York Nets, who finished just 4 games above 500. Coached by future Basketball Hall of Famer Lou Carnesecca, and the Nets behind future Hall of Famer Rick Barry, along with Bill Melchione and Billy Pauls, aka the Whopper, they upset the Colonels in 6 games. In Game 6 at the Nassau Coliseum, 6 Colonels finished in double figures, including Gilmore, who had 24 points in the loss. But it was the Nets' John Roche with a game-high 32 that eliminated the Colonels in the biggest ABA postseason upset in league history. Once again, the Colonels had a postseason appearance, but didn't get to play for the ultimate prize. The next season, the Colonels had another great season, although it wasn't as dominant as the 72 season. In 73, the Colonels went 56-28 in the regular season, but in the postseason, it was a different story. In the first round, Kentucky defeated the Virginia Squires in 5 games. Then in a 7-game classic, the Colonels defeated the Larry Brown-coached Carolina Cougars, led by Billy Cunningham and Jumpin' Joe Caldwell, to advance to the ABA Finals against their rivals, the Indiana Pacers. In another grueling 7-game series, the Colonels fell short to the Pacers in a low-scoring 88-81 Game 7, denying Kentucky an ABA title. In 74, the Colonels had another 50-win season, but fell short of matching what they had done the year before. In 73, they were 1 win away from the ABA title. Yet in 74, the Colonels would be swept in the Eastern Division by the New York Nets in 4 games. Then came 1975. Now, if you're keeping score at home, the Colonels have been in the postseason every year of the ABA. They were one of the more consistent winners of the ABA. They have 3 of the best players in the league. However, they had been to the ABA Finals twice, once in 71 and once in 73, losing to the Utah Stars and the Indiana Pacers respectively, but no titles. That offseason, the Colonels, who had somewhat of a revolving door at head coach, replaced Babe McCarthy with a young assistant from the NBA's Milwaukee Bucks named Hubie Brown. That year, once again, the Colonels' Big Three, they finished at the top of the Eastern Division with a 58-26 record that included a 10-game winning streak to finish the season. In the Eastern semifinals, they quickly dispatched the Memphis Sounds in 5 games, then did the same to the Spirits of St. Louis that featured future NBA star Maurice Lucas, Marvin Mad News Barnes, and Steve Snapper Jones, who would become one of the best NBA television analysts of the 90s. Waiting for the Colonels in the finals with the Western Division champion, their old rivals from a couple of years earlier, the Indiana Pacers. And after winning the first 2 games in Louisville, the Colonels would go up 3-0 after beating the Pacers 109-101 in the brand new Market Square Arena, leaving the Colonels just 1 game away from their first league title. The Pacers would avoid the sweep in Game 4, but all that did was to delay the inevitable. In Game 5, back at Freedom Hall in Louisville, Artis Gilmore scored 28 points and grabbed 31 rebounds to lead Kentucky over Indiana 110-105 for the Colonels' first and only ABA title. The next season would prove to be the last of the American Basketball Association, and the Colonels were determined to finish on top. After winning 58 games in 75, the Colonels were to win just 46 in 76. That season, the league had shrunk to 9 teams as the season started. But 15 games into the regular season, the San Diego Sales and the Utah Stars folded, leaving just 7 teams to finish the regular season. The Colonels finished 4th in this new 7-team league and defeated the Pacers in the first round in 3 games. They would face the Denver Nuggets in what they would call the league semifinals. And ironically, they would face former teammate Dan Issel in the series, who was traded to Denver the previous offseason. The series would last 7 games, with Game 7 taking place on April 28, 1976. And it turned out it would be the final game in franchise history. In Denver's McNichols Arena, Gilmore and Dampier each had 17 points in a 133-110 loss, ending the season and the franchise. The Nuggets and the New York Nets would face off in the final ABA Finals, which the Nets would win in six games. These two teams, along with the Indiana Pacers and the San Antonio Spurs, would merge with the NBA starting that fall of 1976. But what happened to the Colonels? And why did the NBA choose the Indiana Pacers instead of the Kentucky Colonels? The Colonels were the winningest franchise in league history, but were not part of the merger agreement. And to complicate matters even further, in the final standings in the ABA's final season, the Colonels actually finished seven games ahead of the Pacers. With a team and organization that was as successful as the Colonels, there were a couple of reasons why they didn't merge with the NBA. And for that answer, ask the Chicago Bulls. The Bulls realized that an NBA team in Indianapolis would encroach on their own fan base at a time which stretched into Indiana. However, they had several incentives to support Indiana's entry into the league. First, the Bulls predate the ABA and the Pacers by a year, so they themselves were a young franchise and never really were able to develop much of a following in Indiana by the mid-1970s. The Bulls believed that if fans in Indiana knew they had a hand in eliminating the Pacers from existence, they would never be able to cultivate a following in Indiana. Also, the Bulls had developed a rivalry with the Milwaukee Bucks, which was a very lucrative one, and they decided it would be more profitable for them to have a team in nearby Indianapolis than keeping the Pacers out. And the second reason? Artis Gilmore. The Bulls drafted Gilmore out of Jacksonville University in 1971 and owned his rights. Thus, if the Colonels were allowed into the NBA, Gilmore would be part of the Colonels. If not, then the Bulls would have first dibs on the All-ABA center. On June 17, 1976, the owner of the Colonels, John Y. Brown, reached a financial agreement with the remaining ABA clubs and folded the franchise in exchange for $3 million. Brown would use that money to purchase the then Buffalo Braves and then parlay that into becoming owner of the Boston Celtics later on. Gilmore would be selected by the Bulls, while Louis Dampier, the first ever draft pick by the Colonels and the ABA's all-time leader in scoring and assists, were taken by the San Antonio Spurs for $20,000. The ABA was truly a colorful league with the high-octane play, three-point shot, outrageous players, and not to mention the basketball. Some may even think that this was a gimmicky league, but the league did have some substance and great teams. But the best team throughout that league's history now only lives in the memory. Sure, there were the Miami Floridians and the Baltimore Claws and the Pittsburgh Pipers, but the Kentucky Colonels were more than just a great team. They were ABA royalty, fitting for the basketball traditions of the Bluegrass State. Now, over in the NFL. In the midst of all the free agency moves that teams are making heading into the upcoming NFL draft, one storyline has dominated sports talk radio and television debate programs, and that is, what will the Chicago Bears do with last season's quarterback Justin Fields? And will the Bears draft presumptive number one pick Caleb Williams, the Heisman Trophy quarterback out of USC? Well, this past weekend, that question was finally answered as Fields was traded from the Windy City to the Steel City as he would join newly signed Super Bowl winning quarterback Russell Wilson in Pittsburgh. Now, since that domino has fallen, the Bears now have their sights on Caleb Williams to be the next to be the top pick in this year's NFL draft to take place next month in Detroit. Now, when you talk about the Bears and the great players that have played for that long-storied franchise, the position of quarterback is rarely mentioned. When the long lineage of great players of the Bears are mentioned, mostly are running backs and linebackers that have been the most famous Bears of all, but not quarterbacks. And that is the reason why in this draft, this should be maybe the most important in Bears history because in a quarterback-driven league such as the NFL is now, the Bears have to get this right. It is a fact that the most famous Chicago Bears signal caller is Sid Luckman, but he retired 73 years ago. From 1939 to 1950, Luckman, who attended Columbia University, played 128 games for the Bears and passed for 132 touchdowns in his career, and more importantly, led the Bears to four NFL championships in the 1940s. And since his retirement in 1950, no Bears quarterback have had that type of impact from the quarterback position, nor have there been one as popular or as talented. In the 1950s, there was the likes of Johnny Lujack and Ed Brown and George Blanda. Yes, that George Blanda, who won AFL titles with the Houston Oilers and was a clutch performer for the Oakland Raiders in the early 1970s. Then in the 60s, there was Billy Wade, who led them to the NFL title in 1963, which was mostly a defensive-driven team. Then there was Rudy Bukich and Jack Concannon, who was the Bears signal callers during the 60s when they had Gale Sayers and Dick Butkus, but were mired in last place finishes. Heading into the 70s, there was Bobby Douglas and Gary Huff and Bob Abilene, who handed the ball off to a young running back from Jackson State named Walter Payton. Then heading into the 1980s, there was Vince Evans, who was one of the first yet one of the more overlooked black quarterbacks in the NFL. Then there was the quarterback carousel between Jim McMahon and Mike Tomczak that lasted through the duration of the 1980s, despite the fact that McMahon won a Super Bowl but would never be considered a generational type quarterback. Into the 1990s, there was Jim Harbaugh, now the coach of the LA Chargers. Then there was the likes of Steve Walsh and Eric Kramer and Shane Matthews and Dave Craig, which Chicago was one of his many stops in the years after he had left the Seattle Seahawks. As the calendar turned into the 21st century, the Bears were still looking for that elite quarterback. They trotted out Cade McNown and Cordell Stewart and Chad Hutchinson and Kyle Orton and Rex Grossman. Y'all remember Rex Grossman? Okay, Grossman would lead the Bears to Super Bowl 41, ultimately losing to Peyton Manning of the Indianapolis Colts. And then after that, there was Brian Greasy. And then there was Jay Cutler, the strong-armed quarterback from the Broncos. And before that, Vanderbilt University. And he led them to an appearance in the NFC Championship game. But his personality sort of ruined his stay in the Windy City. Although he broke most of Sid Luckman's records with the Bears, it is hard to consider him an all-time great quarterback, even with that lineage of the Bears I was just talking about. And then to round out the list of the not-so-great Bears quarterbacks, there was Matt Barkley, then Mitchell Trubisky, and for the previous three seasons, Justin Fields. So, looking back on this list of what I call the all-time average list, the Bears, for the sake of history and for the common good, especially with Bears fans, they have to get this draft right. Coming up after the timeout, we're going to send a shout out to the only head coach to lead the Colonels to their only ABA title in the spring of 1975. Of course, you know him as a basketball lifer, better known for his X's and O's knowledge that he dispels on television. He is a two-time NBA Coach of the Year award winner, an award that he won 26 seasons apart. We will highlight the career of one Hubie Brown in this edition of our Historically Speaking Sports podcast and our shout-out segment coming up right after this, right here on the Sports History Network.
We here at the Sports History Network proudly partner with 26 podcasts, all revolving around the history of sports. But did you know that many of our hosts were sports history authors way before they started their shows? It's true. We've got Joe Ziemba, host of When Football Was Football. Joe Zagurski, host of Pro Football in the 1970s. Mark Morthier, host of Yesterday Sports. Tommy Phillips, host of Lombardi Memories. And Scott Adamson, co-host of From the 55-Yard Line. All these authors have many books for you to choose from. To check them out, go to our website at sportshistorynetwork.com/sportshistorybooks. Pick up your copy today. Soundtrack provided by Kevin MacLeod of filmmusic.io.
To conclude this episode of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, we do what we always do here at this point of the show, is to send a shout out to an individual or team or event in the world of sports history that has been maybe overlooked or forgotten about, but is very relevant even to this day, and sports fans really need to be reminded of. Now, to be completely honest, I have always been interested in not only who played in the big games on television, I was also somewhat interested secondarily in the men who was calling the game on television from the booth or courtside. Now, as a young fan of basketball in the early to mid 1980s, I was aware of Hubie Brown. The first time I had heard of him was when he was the head coach of the Knicks in the early 1980s. And one of my earliest basketball memories was in 1984 when the Knicks and the Pistons had that unbelievable playoff game at Joe Louis Arena that the Knicks had won, and Bernard King finished with 44 points. The coach for the Knicks that afternoon was indeed Hubie Brown. The next time I had heard of Hubie Brown was a few years later, as he would replace Tom Heinsohn as the color analyst for CBS when they had the NBA. And let me just say, and maybe it is because I was younger and maybe more impressionable, and maybe because we had the Celtics and Lakers in the finals almost every year, but I would like to say that the NBA seemed better and cooler on CBS than anywhere else. Yes, even better than when it was on NBC with Marv Albert, but I digress. And I think one of those reasons why it seemed so much better and so much cooler was because of Hubie Brown. As an analyst who is still doing games to this day on ESPN at the ripe young age of 90, to me, he is one of the few television analysts, along with my opinion, the late John Madden in football and the late great Joe Morgan in Major League Baseball, and his former NBA partner in crime, Dr. Jack Ramsey. It just seemed like anytime that they were calling a game from courtside, it was a good chance that you were going to learn something about the game that you either never knew or never noticed. Those men knew the game inside and out, and it seemed that, especially in the case of Hubie Brown, he had seen and had been in every game situation multiple times and could give you several different solutions to that in-game scenario. He was born in 1933 and attended Niagara University from 1951 to 1955. And after several coaching stops at the high school level, he became an assistant coach at William & Mary in 1967. And from there, he went on to be an assistant coach at Duke University under Coach Bucky Waters. Then, in 1972, he moved up to the NBA and became an assistant coach under Larry Costello with the Milwaukee Bucks. And was on the staff with the Bucks in the 1974 NBA Finals between the Bucks and the Celtics, which I consider one of the best NBA Finals ever. With his work with the Bucks, it propelled them to be head coach of the ABA's Kentucky Colonels, which he would coach for the duration of that franchise, leading them to its only ABA title in 1975, and would coach them until the team folded after the 1976 season. And after the demise of the ABA, he would return to coaching and become head coach of the Atlanta Hawks from 1976 to 81. And during that tenure in the ATL, Brown would be named NBA Coach of the Year in 1978, his first of two Coach of the Year honors. His second Coach of the Year, he would win during his tenure with the Memphis Grizzlies in 2004, 26 seasons apart. And in between that time, and continuing until this day, Hubie Brown became one of the premier voices of the NBA, and for me, I learned more about the game of basketball from him than any other person on or off TV. He finished with a .486 career winning percentage as a professional coach and was inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame as a contributor in 2005. Thank you for listening, And this will do it for this edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, coming to you from the Bill King Memorial Studio here in the sports wing of TM4 Enterprises, located in suburban Atlanta in the shadow of Stone Mountain. And just a reminder to everyone out there, to get more content of Historically Speaking Sports, you can check us out on Twitter or X or Twitter X or whichever it is. You can check us out at historicallysp2, or you can send us a line at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And if you have not done so already, please subscribe to the show. It helps us out tremendously here at Historically Speaking Sports. And as a reminder, tell your family, tell your friends, tell your neighbors. Hell, tell a passerby on the street if you think they like sports history. And once again, thank you for joining me. And until next time, please stay blessed and stay cool and be the best in everything that you do. Peace.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.